feedback coming from the end of Sergey's set here. That's some Ryoji Ikeda, all the way from Japan, live in the studio here at K Chung Radio.
Some harsh data there.
Some big data from Ryoji Ikeda's, what, late 90s effort, plus minus, 1998 or something like that? Is that when that record came out?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
19, yeah.
Anyhow.
That's old Ryoji Ikeda.
Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, here, as always, with Steve Kato.
Hi there. I'm Steve Kato. And I'm just going to close this laptop in front of me for a second.
Excellent.
Nicholas, we have had quite a week this week.
Yeah, not much sleep this week for the talking show.
No sleep till talking show. Mm. No. We are also really lucky. There was a moment earlier today when it was believed that the archival recording of last week's guest on the talking show, Mark So and Company.
Oh my goodness.
Had vanished.
My heart just stopped.
My heart stopped as well. It was a unique performance that was unrepeatable.
But surely our audio engineer found the recording, right?
Yay!
Indeed. So the odds were ever in our favor, and we found the recordings.
Thank goodness. That's some good data.
Bless Solomon.
Thank the data.
Long may Solomon reign.
I heard Solomon's laboratory is coming along swimmingly.
I hear so too. Yeah, I have yet to be invited inside. I wonder how he's working on the positive pressure situation.
I texted him recently, and it just said need to level the tables. Working on positive pressure system.
Okay, so it's on its way.
I suggested a really the title of the work must be some kind of acronym like LYYT Labs or something like
that. Right.
And he said he was struggling with the name.
He has asked me many times about the name as well.
Yeah.
I think he looks to me as like maybe someone who's good at marketing.
Or I don't know. You know, I don't know what Solomon's relationship to language is.
As with most deity-type figures, I think the relationship to language is complex and many-faceted.
In that he appears to be outside of language, but it probably has the firmest of grasps.
Like Yahweh before him.
Right, the unutterable name.
Right, I mean, and let's be honest, someone who made the world in out of language in just 7 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of language, the talking show had a brief outing this evening with Ryan Jeffrey Jr.
Yes, the filmmaker.
We discussed quite a bit of financial news.
We discussed recent financial news that also pertained to former talking show guest Elon Musk, among other things. Now is an okay but not stellar time to buy Tesla shares.
And apparently Steve's play portfolio of defense industry stocks is doing quite well.
Yes, a Canadian financial services company will let you open a fake stock portfolio. And back when I was considering being an evil person, I fake invested about $200,000 of fake money in a fake portfolio of extremely aggressive defense industry
toxic stock.
And had I in fact invested $200,000, which is impossible, but given that $200,000 would have to have first been acquired, which it was in fact not, but had I in fact invested $200,000 in Northrop Grumman, more so than Raytheon or General Dynamics or any of the other companies I was considering investing in and that I invested in partially, I think Northrop Grumman stocks are up something like 30%.
Way to go.
For $200,000, I could have earned a year's worth of income in just a few months.
Yeah.
Invest
and the world
Satan.
Would be a better place.
Yeah.
Speaking of financial news, just before coming here, or just before meeting you and Mr. Jeffrey Jr., I watched a documentary on the subprime market crash called The Flaw.
Oh,
yeah.
Was it good?
It was good. It had a trying to think of the style of documentary. It was like, you know, this kind of limp leftist documentary with lots of like you know, helicopter shots of New York with dramatic music and cutting back and forth to like supposedly authoritative intellectuals, like, you know, everyone was from Harvard or Columbia or whatever.
Sure. Everyone is from Harvard or Columbia.
True. Anyone who has any real opinion.
I'm from the biggest university in Canada.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
But and there was this montage in the opening where it appeared as if everyone had been asked what caused the subprime market crash, and they all had extremely differing opinions, of course, all these experts. But the one thing that
they're all, cats, dogs, like pizza,
yeah, pizza inflation, Indian pizza, tandoori pizza,
Koji truck, Korean tacos, yeah,
Tesla Motors,
the electric car, finally.
No, but the one thing that they all said was the wealth disparity, the income disparity.
You know, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
And you see the graphs are pretty simple. It's pretty clear. It's pretty easy to see what's going on.
Looks pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
Well, good thing we at Kaechung and our rich financial backers are on the top of that financial pyramid and can look down from those heights in confidence, knowing that A, Kaechung will be ever bankrolled the deluxe investments of the benign Solomon.
Well, that was something that I hadn't really thought through, is that the problem with most of the wealth being compounded in the top 1% is that the wealthiest people do not buy commodities. They buy assets.
And so you mean that they don't buy toasters, like they've got a toaster?
They don't. I mean, they don't support Kaechung in the way that they should. They instead buy real estate or stocks or these kinds of things. And the problem with an inflated asset market is that, unlike commodities, as the price starts going up with a commodity, mm-hmm. then it eventually has to come back down.
Right.
Whereas with assets, the better way to say it is, as the price of a commodity goes up, the demand goes down.
Right.
And the inverse happens with an asset.
Kaechung, though, is Kaechung not an artwork?
Oh, wow. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
So therefore, we don't have time to deal with that question. Is it not?
Yeah, I don't, but it's not ownable in the way that a Rashid Johnson painting is ownable.
But who could ever cage that wild, wild spirit?
Of Rashid or Kaechung? True. My briefest of interactions with that man has led me to believe that he's uncageable.
Cage free.
Rashid. Anyhow.
And we saw recently, also very late at night, a wonderful Mark So performance.
That's true. What was it? Monday night at midnight? The tail end of his week of midnight performances. The front end of that being Kaechung Radio.
Last week, this time.
Yeah, Mark So performed with Julie Holter and Sepand Shabab at what is it, Curtis Barak's Harpsichord Factory?
Harpsichord Services. Yes.
Right. There were dozens and dozens of Flemish harpsichords.
It was outrageous.
In a basement.
It was an outrageous venue. I've never been in a place with so many antique keyboard instruments in my life.
Yeah. Anyhow.
Let's keep things Slavic tonight, huh? So that was Sergey for a second, and coming up we have a guest whose interests will span all of the topics we've just discussed through the body of the internet and the economy.
Dealing with our greatest asset.
The internet. Ourselves.
Technology.
Data. Our guest in the studio is none other than the extremely distinguished Evgeny Mortsov, formerly of the New Republic, just after the recent buyout, just sort of left, contributor to innumerable publications, all of which are A-lister publications, formerly of Belarus, now proud American, ladies and gentlemen, Evgeny Mortsov.
Thank you so much for this introduction. I don't actually see any animus here, so I assume we're all friends. It's, if you can believe it, it's actually the last talk of my book tour, so I can finally speak up my mind and be very finally be very controversial. I was here 2 years ago for the first time to promote my first book, which was a book about the impact that the internet and social media were having on authoritarian states, and that's how I initially myself got into this field. I was born in Belarus. That's where I grew up. And those of you who don't know, Belarus still has a very complicated political situation since mid-90s. It's been a pretty ugly authoritarian regime. And the reason why I initially got excited about the power of social media and the power of the internet was because I thought that we can actually use blogs and social networks, a lot of this digital technologies, to push for democracy in the country, right? And I was a very cheerful and utopian young fellow who actually thought we can use many of these tools to build a better world. And after 3 years of working in Belarus and traveling through our the former Soviet Union, working for a couple of NGOs and foundations, I quickly got disillusioned, figuring out that the dictators themselves were very active users of many of these technologies. But I also figured out that that was not something that was understood in Washington, right? I figured out that a lot of our policymakers and a lot of our journalists and intellectuals still thought that the internet and blogs and social media were primarily responsible for liberating the world, for empowering dissidents, and they did not pay as much time to understanding how various software tools were actually used to monitor and spy on dissidents, how they were used to engage in propaganda, engage in cyber attacks, and a lot of those tools were actually built right here in Silicon Valley, and we didn't really have any restrictions placed on those companies, while at the same time, we were actually celebrating the role that the likes of Google and Facebook were playing in many of those countries, right? So we, part of my argument in my first book was that we in Washington, a lot of our policymakers are increasingly relying on Silicon Valley to actually promote democracy in the Middle East and elsewhere. And I was trying to investigate what are some of the costs of delegating something that we used to do out of the State Department to essentially Facebook, Google, and Twitter, right? And then to sort of give away the ending of my first book, I wasn't particularly encouraged by the trends I saw, and I thought that there are many hidden costs and risks attached to having Facebook and Twitter and Google as the primary or even secondary promoters of democracy. So what I tried to do in my second book was to shift the attention a little bit, but still stick to the basic question. What happens once we delegate some of the responsibility for problem solving to Silicon Valley and to technology companies and the private sector in general? But the questions and the problems I focused on became very different. So instead of thinking about democratization and how we can promote freedom and democracy, I began asking questions about what happens once we delegate responsibility over fighting problems like climate change or problems like obesity, for example, to Silicon Valley. Right? What happens once we rely on technology, we rely on apps, we rely on technological fixes to address some of those problems, right? And so that was the basic research question with which I started the book. The reason why I think this question is worth asking now is because of two trends that have happened. Those trends are as follows. First of all, sensors with an S. You know, I spent my first book talking a lot about censorship, and there was a lot of sensors with a C in that book. In the second book, there is a lot of sensors with an S, and it's, you know, little tiny sensing devices which can be embedded now in virtually anything, right? You can embed sensors into cars, tables, walls, teapots, anything to generate new levels of interactivity, right? They can provide you with new information. You can make devices that were previously analog and dumb, so to say, you can make them smart, right? So you may have heard about smart devices and smart objects, right, which all incorporate sensors of some kind. So you may have heard that Apple recently patented smart shoes, right? So what do smart shoes do? They have a sensor built into them, and that sensor can figure out when the shoes are about to get worn out, and they will alert you, right, that that's happening. Has a sensor, gives you a prompt, results in a somewhat different decision. We have seen earlier this year the presentation of smart forks at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. What do? They have a sensor in them, and they can actually monitor how fast you're eating. So if they detect that you're eating too fast, they will start vibrating, telling you that you need to slow down. Again, the principle is the same. You take a previously dumb artifact, you built a sensor into it, it can detect what it is you're doing with it, and it can prompt you to behave differently. Right? The principle is the same in many of these devices. The same, you know, I can go on forever. You have smart toothbrushes, right, which again have a sensor and can monitor how fast you are brushing your teeth, and they can actually share that data with your insurance company, with your dentist, right? You have smart umbrellas that have a sensor built into them, and they have internet connectivity built into them that can detect, check the weather, and actually have a little blue light that goes on if the weather says that it's going to rain. So the umbrella will actually warn you to take it with you when you leave the house, right? Again, the principle in all of these examples I've specified is very similar. You take previously dumb objects, previously dumb devices, you build a sensor into them, and they allow, because they add extra information to the object, they can allow new types of behavior and solicit new types of behavior from the user, right? And that allows for new ways of problem solving. And I'll talk about that there shortly, but you know, you can basically see what the principle is. The principle is that you can give the user more information and thus get the user to behave differently, right? So that's the principle. And the first trend is the proliferation of sensors that are getting cheaper and smaller. The second trend is easier, I think, to grasp, and it's the fact that because we're all present on social networks and because we're all carrying our smartphones with us, what has happened is that you can now basically take your entire social circle with you anywhere you go, right? So in Silicon Valley, people talk about it as the social, right? Now everything can be turned social, in part because pretty much every interaction that you have with each other or with social institutions can now be mediated, so to say, by a social circle, right? So you can have apps. There is actually an app called Seesaw, which allows you to create instantaneous polls. If you are stuck with a difficult decision, you don't know what latte to buy, right? Or you don't know what dress to buy, or you don't know what politician to vote for, you can create an instantaneous poll with your smartphone, poll all of your friends immediately, solicit feedback, and make a decision, right? The principle, again, is simple, that connectivity and the fact that your social circles are portable and they are immediately accessible allow to solicit new types of information, and they allow you to make new types of behavior. But you can also think about this principle, even more expansively, because since your friends more or less follow with you everywhere you go with your phone, you can create games, right, where you actually participate in competition with other people. And that's also something that Silicon Valley has stepped into in the last few years. Those of you who live and work here may have noticed the rise of the so-called gamification, right? And it's this principle that you can actually turn virtually anything into a game by rewarding people with points, right, for doing things that they previously did because they, you know, thought it was the right thing to do, or they did it because they, you know, wanted to save the world, or they wanted to do something good for humanity. Now, you can bypass all of this inefficient moral and ethical incentives, and instead of relying on ethics, essentially start rewarding people with virtual currencies or some other types of currencies, you know, in terms of attention, for performing all sorts of acts. So you can start compensating people for, you know, picking up litter from the street, because you all carry cell phones and your cell phones can identify, because they also have sensors, when it is that you're reaching out to pick up some litter. You can easily automatically build a compensation system that will reward you with points that you can then compare with your friends. So this is the second trend, right? The fact that you can actually carry your friends with you, that allows for new types of peer pressure. And some of that peer pressure can be positive. It can be showing your friends how good you are and what are some of the things you do. And some of that pressure can be negative. It's kind of, you know, shaming, saying, showing your friends that you're not doing the good thing. So how do those two trends interact? For me, a very good anecdotal example of these two trends in action is a prototype design that I found built by engineers and designers in Britain and Germany. It's a product called BinCam, right? So what does BinCam do? BinCam is a smart trash can, right? So it's a trash can that stands in your kitchen, and of course it has a sensor built into it, and in this case the sensor is a smartphone, right, that's built into its upper lid, right? And just before I continue, it's a serious project, right? It's not an art project built by some art students. It's an actual project built by serious designers who are concerned with saving the planet and changing recycling habits, right? So it's a serious intervention. So we're talking about a smart trash bin. It has a smartphone built into its upper lid. And the purpose of this phone is to take a photo every time you open or close the lid. So the idea is that you can actually snap a picture of what it is you have just thrown away. Right? Why would anyone want to do such a thing? Well, the idea is that after you snap that photo, it's being uploaded to a website called Mechanical Turk, which is run by Amazon, where freelancers are paid to do things that computers cannot do yet. So in this case, freelancers are being paid to analyze whether you're recycling things correctly or not. And if you're recycling things correctly, you're being awarded points, which along with the photo are uploaded to your Facebook page, where you're competing against other households, right? So the idea is that something as trivial as throwing away trash can be turned into a nice little game where new types of ethical behavior, right, or in this case, correct behavior, can be solicited from you as a citizen, right? Bypassing essentially the language of morality and the language of ethics, right? Because now you can actually get people to do the right thing, in this case, recycle, without having any conceptual model of understanding what is right and wrong, because essentially they will be doing it because they are competing against other households, right? And this might seem like a very compressed and trivial example, but I think it very nicely illustrates the new types of possibility of problem solving that have suddenly become possible thanks to those two trends. Thanks to the fact that sensors can now be built in almost anything, and thanks to the fact that now almost anything can be made social. So essentially, my argument is that we have ended up with a new type of privately run infrastructure for problem solving, right? And this infrastructure is run by Silicon Valley, it's run by Google, it's run by Facebook, it's run by companies who own and run the smartphones and run the gadgets, and then it's also run by companies that run the platforms where we are socializing with each other. So now that we as a society have this infrastructure, the question for us becomes, how much do we want to use it? And if we are not going to use it, what are some of the reasons for not using it? Right? What are some of the reasons for refusing to rely on the smart trash bin? Right? Do we want to do it because we are just concerned about privacy? Which I think is a valid excuse, because technically, if you think about the privacy implications here, basically, in the past, FBI could not just go to you know, you and ask what was in your trash can 3 weeks ago. I mean, they can, but they would never find out documentally what the answer was. Now, if the smart environments take over, they would be able to go to Facebook and just ask them for a picture of what was in your trash can 3 weeks ago, and they will get it, right? So the fact that, you know, it's the same principle with the smart toothbrush, right? It has all sorts of benefits. It can monitor data that will end up with your dentist and might, you know, improve your teeth eventually or save you from some extra trouble. But it also creates an environment in which a lot of this trivial data is suddenly accessible and it's suddenly collected. I can't possibly imagine why FBI would want to know how many teeth you have or what was in your mouth 3 weeks ago, but this data, thanks to smart devices, is now recorded, analyzed, and stored somewhere, right? So it becomes accessible. So the privacy layer is important to consider, but I would argue that it's not the only reason why we should worry about the proliferation of smart objects on the one hand, and then these new types of social incentives like gamification. Another reason
to worry, and I think it's much more important, is that solving problems in this manner by essentially having citizens readjust their own behavior, whether it comes to recycling or whether it comes to climate change, is a very particular way of doing politics, and it's only one way to pursue reforms, and there are many others. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best way. So let me unpack what exactly I mean by this. So some of you may know Google Now, right? The app that Google has built last year. Those of you who don't know it, it seems like a very useful app. So what Google Now does is that it analyzes everything that you do across all of the Google services. So it analyzes what you do on your Gmail, it analyzes what you do on your Google Calendar, it analyzes what you do on YouTube, it analyzes what you search for, and then it tries to predict what you might be doing in the near future. Next day, next hour, next week, and then it tries to do some of those things for you, right? So the principle is that you can actually predict what you'll be doing next and have Google do it for you as long as it's something trivial and would otherwise cause you some trouble. So to give you an example, which Google likes to give all the time, is that imagine you have a flight reservation in your inbox and Google knows that you'll be catching a flight later today. So it will automatically, thanks to Google Now, check you into your flight. It will automatically check the weather at your destination, and it will tell you that it might rain, so you might need to get an umbrella. No, it will never get wet in this new digital future. And it will also check the traffic conditions on the way to the airport, and it will tell you that there is traffic, so you might need to leave sooner. Right? So you're trying to make your life easier by essentially analyzing what it is you'll be doing, and it's trying to preempt it and provide you with information that will simplify your life, or it will just do some of the things like checking in itself. All of that sounds very good, but now it also does an additional thing as well. It also analyzes, thinks it's a smartphone app, and your smartphone has a sensor, an accelerometer in it, which knows when it is that you're walking and when it is that you're not walking. It actually tracks how many miles you walk every month. Right? And at the end of each month, without you ever asking for it, it shows you how many miles you've walked in the last months, and it shows you whether this month you've walked more, or whether this month you walked less than the previous months. Right? It shows you the percentage change. And here, those of you familiar with behavioral economics or the work of Cass Sunstein will recognize that what Google is essentially doing is trying to create a nudge. Right? It's trying to do something that will hopefully result in a different behavior from you, right? It's trying to show you information which will hopefully modify your behavior, and in this case will make you walk more, it will make you exercise more, or you know, you can think of many other interventions which become possible, again, thanks to the fact that Google runs this new information-based infrastructure for problem solving. You know, with Google Glass, as we'll all soon be wearing, as you probably already well aware, you'll be able to monitor even more things, and you'll be able to create even more nudges, again, in part because so much of our activities will be monitored for good purposes, and it will be easy to just display reminders and tell us that we are eating too much fat, we're not eating enough vegetables. All of that feedback can be generated in real time based on our own behavior. So in this sense, Google Now is an early precursor of the kind of ubiquitous nudging that suddenly becomes available as we're all interconnected to this new problem-solving infrastructure. And you might think that what could possibly be wrong with telling you that you need to walk more, right? Or that you need to eat more vegetables. And I think that as a bonus, as an additional feature to other types of problem solving, this is a very good intervention. However, I'm not sure that given the intellectual climate and the broader socioeconomic background to the introduction of many of these initiatives, I'm not sure that this will be a bonus. And I actually think that it will be a replacement of many of the existing efforts to reform problems, to solve problems like obesity or climate change. Essentially, what's happening is that we are replacing more ambitious ways to tackle these political issues. And what are some of those ways? It's passing new laws, regulating industries, building infrastructure. I mean, there are all sorts of things which do not require building an app, which tackle a problem at a much higher level, and actually tries not just to put some temporary patch on the problem and pretend that it doesn't exist, but getting citizens to behave differently, but actually goes and try to address the root causes of the problem, right? And it could be the fact that in the case of obesity, that the food industry is poorly regulated. It could be that the way it advertises to kids is poorly regulated. Or it could be, you know, there are all sorts of other factors that might need to be considered, which I'm afraid is not considered at all. In part because what we are doing is essentially asking the citizen to adjust their own behavior within the constraints of the system, which itself is treated as completely fixed and unchangeable, right? So you're being told that you need to move more, but we're not necessarily asking questions about whether there is anywhere to move, actually, right? And that's the fundamental question that you cannot solve with an app, right? Because apps are very good at generating behavioral change in citizens and users, but my fear is that very soon we'll forget that there are other ways to tackle problems, right? And there are other way, more ambitious ways in which we can actually go and do something about the problematic situation we're in. And I think if you think about a problem like obesity, you can see, take someone like Michelle Obama. So Michelle Obama started a very ambitious campaign when Barack Obama got elected to do something about obesity, right? And her first move, if you look at the rhetoric in 2008-2009, was that we need to do something about food companies, right? We need to do something about the food industry, and she was very ambitious. 5 years later, as you follow the news, you'll see what that effort has come to. It has become all about planting vegetables in your own garden and moving more, right? And moving more is an interesting intervention, but moving more is not necessarily as ambitious as regulating the food industry. And it's something that doesn't require any fights in Washington, and it doesn't require any political intervention that is actually difficult and requires structural reforms. So part of my argument, and I know it's taking a long time to deliver this point, is that as we have seen the emergence of this new problem-solving infrastructures, we're also facing governments who are, for many reasons, very interested in exploring this infrastructure. And some of those reasons have to do that with the fact that we are living through the times of austerity, where governments just don't have money for solving many of those problems. We're also living through the times where governments have tried many of, like Michelle Obama, they have tried many of these fixes, more ambitious fixes, whether it's laws or regulations, and they haven't worked. They're also facing industries that have found ways to organize and mobilize very well, and they're opposing any efforts at regulation. So this is the bad news. And the good news is that everyone loves building apps, everyone loves innovation, and everyone wants to be seen as being in friendly to Silicon Valley. So you have a lot of policymakers who are very excited about exploring these new tools, who are very excited about exploring apps, who are very excited about these new technologies for reasons that I've just outlined. They either run out of other options, they run out of money, or they just want to be seen as someone on the cutting edge. And as far as actual problem-solving efforts are concerned, this is not good news at all. And this is where I myself am very concerned about where we are headed, because I don't believe that, you know, as much as I think that nudging is a good idea, I don't think that they can tackle complex problems, because you cannot tackle these complex problems by forcing citizens, asking citizens to change their behavior. You need to change how institutions and industries work. And unfortunately, we don't have apps for that. It requires much more difficult types of interventions. So, what I do in my book is basically try to analyze the rise of what I call solutionism, right? And what I've just described this, I think, fits under the solutionist umbrella. But solutionism to me has many, many other components and many other sides. It also describes many efforts to, again, profit from this new infrastructure for problem solving without necessarily asking any deep questions about what got us into this mess in the first place and to what extent some of the solutions may actually make the situation worse. So let me give you an example that might help or might not help. So part of what I'm saying, actually, before I give you the example, is the simple idea that having good intentions is not enough, right? And I think it's a message that is not very often heard in Silicon Valley, where any activity in something that has a social or political dimension is automatically considered good, right? You think as long as some private company expresses a wish to solve a problem like obesity or a problem like climate change, it must be by default a good idea. And you know, you can make the same law, you can make the same statement about NGOs, you can make the same statement about anyone who uses new fancy technology to address many of these problems. And part of what I discovered, even in my first book, was that having good intentions is not enough. I know from my own work in the former Soviet Union that a lot of the work we did in promoting democracy with Western funding in countries like Belarus actually made things much worse for democracy, and we can talk about it later on. So I approach this from the perspective of someone who thinks that good intentions are hardly enough, and very often good intentions backfire. So it's a very long prelude to, I guess, the final anecdote I want to share with you. And it's an anecdote about fact-checking, right? So fact-checking, as you have noticed in the during the last election campaign, right, is something that has really taken off in America, right? Everyone wants to fact-check everyone, including the fact-checkers, and then including the people who fact-check the fact-checkers, right? And it's become the new fetish in the country. And part of that has to do with the fact that so much information is being stored. Right, you can pretty much go and easily transcribe any statement made by politicians. You can easily store it in a database. You can easily bring it up. I mean, a show like The Daily Show would be impossible 20 years ago because you know you didn't have TiVo, you didn't have all sorts of other tools, right? So you would not be able to pull so many quotes in 20 minutes. So what's happening now is that, as you probably well know, you have a couple of media organizations, media nonprofits like PolitiFact, and there are a few others, which try to fact-check statements made by politicians or intellectuals, anyone else, and try to rank them on a scale from, you know, 1 to 5, or true to false, with a lot of points in between, partially true, partially false, neutral. We've seen all of this. So you have a couple of very interesting technological projects built by people who I'm sure have very good ideas. I mean, noble ideas. I described one of them in the book, a project called Truth Goggles, right? And what it does is something very interesting. So since you have these media organizations doing the fact checking, right? They also run databases that contain claims and facts that have been fact checked, right? So they have databases with tens of thousands of claims about, you know, whether the economy is growing at 5 or 10%, that claim has been fact checked. Whether America is spending more money in Afghanistan this year than last year, that claim has been fact checked. So they run all those databases, right? And those databases are accessible to anyone else, so you can actually build an app that will send a request to the database, and then you can actually fact check any information using that database as your source of fact check claims, right? Makes sense so far. So you have someone running a database, you rely on the database, you build an app, then you could do something with that app. So this project, Truth Goggles, does the following. So it's a little extension that you install in your browser, right? And basically, whenever you read an article, say in the New York Times, right? Whenever that extension spots a claim that has been identified as false or partially false, it will highlight that claim in red, right? As to alert you as a reader that something is fishy in this claim and something is fishy in this article. And by extension, claims that are not highlighted in red are considered to be kosher, right? They're okay. You can, like, you don't really have to exercise your critical thinking about something that someone in Washington said, because the fact-checking has been done. So, I mean, in theory, again, this sounds like a very good setup, and you might believe that this will greatly improve the climate for political discussion in America. However, then, of course, you need to start asking the question of how do those media organizations actually fact-check those claims, right? Where does the original data come from? Because it's great to build an app using someone else's database, but if you don't ask questions about how do claims get into the database, how do you know that you're actually improving the public debate and not just amplifying some of the trends that may not be that nice? So in the book, I point to a a couple of claims that PolitiFact has fact-checked, and those are claims about, say, drone warfare, or about the fact, or about the question of whether American government can use drones to target its own citizens, right, if they are suspected of terrorist activities, right? So how does an organization that does media fact-checking verify the truth of such claims? So they ring up three experts in Washington, right, sitting in three different think tanks. Brookings Institution, Council on Foreign Relations, and, you know, I don't know, Carnegie Endowment. And of course, depending on what those experts say, the claim that might otherwise seem normal might seem partially false or partially true, right? And on issues like drone warfare, where there is, or cyber warfare for that matter, where there is a heavy presence in this debate of various defense companies and think tanks, and there is also in many Washington think tanks, you know, they're not exactly always objective reflectors of reality, right? I mean, very often they are tied to ideologies in the White House, and, you know, it's not necessarily that they are sources of wisdom or sources of truth. So if you go and fact check the claim about drone warfare made by someone like, you know, to pick some fringe figure like Noam Chomsky, if you go and ask a bunch of experts at the Brookings Institution and Council on Foreign Relations about Noam Chomsky's opinion about drone warfare, it will probably label it as partially false. Now, whether it's partially false or not is a question mostly of ideology and not of facts. And if we start making claims made by people on the with extreme positions, like Chomsky, and, you know, his position might look extreme, in part because he just falls so outside from the mainstream discourse in Washington, we might actually end up with people being even less critical of the current ideological discourse in Washington and not asking questions about how power operates and how power affects discourse and how power affects what's being said and what's being written in think tanks than we currently have. Right, and then the question becomes, do we actually want to end up in a world where people are suspending judgment in what they read because they have delegated some of the judgment to an extension in their browser, which itself has delegated this judgment to a database compiled by a media think tank, which itself relies on the think tanks, three, you know, think tank experts who might be on the payroll of defense industry. Right, and again, this might be like a very extreme example, but nowhere in the discussions of that fact-checking extension I've seen any concerns about how it might be affecting, for better or worse, the existing climate in America, right? Political climate for political speech and thinking. And here you see one of those most pathological features of solutionism, where you embark on a quest to save the world and solve all of the world's problems without actually spending too much time thinking about what those problems are, how they have emerged, and understanding what some of those layers are, right? You just think that you have a great app, you know what the great app can do, it can fact check, or it can, you know, use a sensor, it can build a gamification scheme into everything, and you don't actually ask all the questions you need to ask if you're really interested in solving the problem. So I don't think you can fix American politics by building the world's greatest app before ever asking what's actually wrong with American politics, right? And again, it might seem like a very trivial statement to make, but I think this is very often missing, and that's why we end up with a lot of supposedly great apps to fix education, or to fix healthcare, or to fix climate change, or to fix a business that do not actually pose very deep questions that we need to pose if we actually want to tackle these problems in the long term and not just to patch them with a very ineffective patch in the short term. So I think we have, I see like you almost like drowning in those questions. So I think I'll probably wrap up here, and I'll be more than happy to take your questions. And my basic point here is that while it's important to be solving problems, very often our solutions create even more problems than they solve. And we need to be very critical about how the problems themselves become problems before necessarily embarking on the kind of solutions that we want to promote. Very often, technological solutions work, but very often they wouldn't. And we need to find a framework in which we can actually start comparing technological fixes to social fixes, but we should also find a framework to be comparing technological fixes with each other, right? And very often they rely on very different logic, and you can't just say that just because a fix or a solution is technological, then it should be dismissed. I mean, that's not the case, and I would argue that a solution that relies on sensors has a very different dynamic than a solution that relies on gamification, right? There are all sorts of political, moral, and ethical implications built into both, and we need to find a way in which to distinguish between them. Whether those are concerns about privacy, whether those are concerns about morality, we need to find a new calculus for evaluating them. We cannot just say that they should be banned outright because they rely on technology or because they rely on society. So I think I'll stop here and be more than happy to take questions. Thank you so much.
Whoa.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Wow, I got some questions.
Well, you know, I mean, Evgeny, pardon us. There, other than us, there is no way we have the time to take questions from the audience here at K-Chung. Also, they are behind the soundproof glass.
Yeah, and to be perfectly frank, as our more intellectual talks go, the audience has thinned out quite a bit at this late hour.
It is pretty late.
I mean, it's tough. I mean, Steve and I are willing to stay up till 2 a.m. listening to harpsichords, but not everyone.
It's not a path for the weak.
No, most people peel off around midnight, my girlfriend included. She said that she had no interest in any late night harpsichords.
And yet, I mean, my significant other also was far more interested in achieving a full night of sleep
than harpsichords or discussions about sensors.
And sensors.
And censorship.
And the social.
You know, I appreciated some of that talking, but I felt the same way that I did about who was our other technological guest.
We've had several.
I know, but the one who had a similar, he was very short talk, maybe a year ago.
Bratton.
Mr. Bratton
from USC.
Yeah, it's a little sad to see that a dialectical view of technology is so rare out there.
Oh, you mean just in the fact that our two guests on this topic have formed just close-knit and isolated community?
Yeah, you know, you'd think that that would be a lot. I appreciate their perspective. I'm on board, and I have my ticket. But it's surprising.
The Habermas quotes didn't help you make that decision, did they?
No. I guess it makes me feel sad that that's such an outsider opinion these days. That, you know, everyone's so optimistic about our communication technologies.
You know, I think it's interesting to think about how people are optimistic about communication technology, like a garbage can that shames you or something like that for not recycling.
Right.
But then think of this, storage problems. Computer storage problems, and hard disks get smaller, but then as hard disks get smaller, the components create more heat because there's just, you know, less room around the components to disperse the heat from the moving parts in a hard disk. And then, you know, so the miniaturization of the hardware moves hand in hand with laptops being able to hold, you know, terabytes of storage or whatever on these tiny 2.5-inch hard drives, and then shortly thereafter they invent solid state storage.
Okay, where are you going with this?
Well, all right, so this is a hard technological as opposed to a soft technological solution to a problem.
It's a hardware problem.
Well, these are technological problems in hardware, mm-hmm. where a design problem is that hard disks generate too much heat.
Okay.
And miniaturization, although it improves the portability of the devices, exacerbates the heat problem. Right?
Okay.
And so instead of developing a better hard disk, the concept of the hard disk is simply done away with. And essentially, an SSD is just like a weird kind of RAM.
Right. It's a big RAM.
It's a big RAM.
Giant RAM.
It's a big RAM, and it's a persistent RAM. And access to it is faster. It generates no heat. You know, like all this. So it's like, on the one hand, I don't trust app developers who are essentially, I think, designers with a darker technical focus to help change the world, but I think like a genuine hardware engineer, someone who's like, hey, have we tried making solid state memory work for us as a storage medium, not just as RAM? You know, like that decision to like take a product oriented in one direction and push it into another field, because it's essentially the same technology as RAM.
Well, I mean, I think the essential difference here is that the engineers are dealing with a material problem and the app developers are dealing with social problems.
Well, they're all material problems at the end of the day. The social, the app developers are essentially interacting with economic material facts and or like you storing your life in the cloud, which as my conversation with Mr. Ryan Jeffries, which, you know, we're talking about this with Ryan earlier, it was interesting to just think about what the physical dimensions of the cloud are. Like, it is a physical place.
Yeah, of course.
And we like to think that the social world is this numinous ether hiding between all of our interactions. But in fact, since we've been doing putting so much of that space on the internet, it's actually occupying a real physical hardware engineering space.
Yeah, but I mean, there are obvious differences between sociological problems and engineering problems, right?
In one sense, yeah.
I mean, in the documentary I was watching, there was lots of footage of Alan Greenspan.
Oh, sexy.
Yeah, giving his, I guess he was a some committee review after the economy collapsed, and I was surprisingly convinced and sympathized with him. You know, even though he made some really bad decisions. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, that he had subscribed to a certain economic ideology, an idea, whose material basis seemed proven and failed.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you're working on the new solid state drive, you hook it up to the power, and if it sparks,
it fails.
It fails immediately, and you know, no one loses their homes. Right? Basically, what I'm saying is that problems based on ideas have a tendency to get far more out of hand.
Oh, I mean, I'm not arguing such. I just think that like the space for technological optimism exists, and that exists in terms of like we will have wearable computers that are far easier, you know, like that are more adaptable to our needs than we could have ever imagined. However, at the same time, we will not solve economic inequality.
Right. I mean, that seemed to be the gist of the talk tonight.
Yeah.
Right. Is that once again, the Apple Watch is not going to, you know, cure leprosy.
And as much as that, I'm sure bums all of us who hold Apple stock out that our canny investment did not
solve
leprosy. Which is also not a social problem, Nicholas.
Leprosy is, in fact,
medical problem and largely irrelevant to us in the first world because of our medical system.
Yeah. Okay. The point being that
what won't it
unfortunately
solve?
We live in a technocracy, and technology is presented as the solution to all of our problems, and in that word the word technology has even really just been tightened up to only mean communication technologies.
Right. As opposed to actual science.
Yeah,
in
or
lots
like
of
you
respects,
know,
the engineering,
the big vehicle that pours the tar on the street.
Yeah,
that's a technology.
Absolutely. I mean, the wheel itself is a technology.
Right.
Which our friends the Aztecs lacked, despite the complexity of their civilization.
Hence the staircases, right?
The unending staircases. Yeah.
I recently saw the logo for that band Chicano Batman. Have you seen that logo?
No. Tell me about Chicano Batman.
I think they're. A Chicano punk band, I think.
Okay.
I think from Texas.
Okay.
And they have the best logo ever. It's the bat symbol, except the wings are stepped.
Ooh. Chicano Batman.
Excellent.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Talking Show.
Yep, signing off for the evening. And remember that what our fat pal Adorno said, all needs are social in nature.
It's a harsh toke, but hopefully you can still sleep tonight.
Gute Nacht.
Gute Nacht.